daydreaming about dragons. Let's talk about hiding shit. Some people would say it's mysteries, but in my experience, very rarely is it mysteries. More often, it's hiding shit, and I don't get it. I don't particularly like it. And I'm not saying you can't have hidden things in your campaign. I'm not saying that the occasional mystery isn't good. I'm saying the point of the campaign should be clear, right? I had a conversation with someone on Reddit, and I was talking to Jay about it last night. And here's the gist of the conversation. They were running a game in which Vecna, the great lich god of secrets and sorcery, was taking over the world. And he said, you know, how long should I take, you know, hide it from the players until they finally find out? And I was like, why not just tell them? Tell them, hey, you know that Vecna is trying to take over the world and become a god or whatever it is. How did you find out? And what brought you all together? And that solves so many problems, right? Because now everyone's together, they're on the same page, they've got a mission. They've given you details about how they found out, so you learn, you get cool ideas. You can build on that. And there's still plenty of mystery to be uncovered. We don't know exactly what Vecna's doing. We don't know exactly what their plans are. It's an ancient, subtle, cunning, brutal, arcane lich. Everything hasn't been uncovered yet. Just the point of the game has been uncovered. And you can make characters that play to that. You know? You can make a half-vampire who is turned by Kaz. For those of you who don't know, Vecna had a lieutenant, a vampire named Kaz, who is said maybe poked at his eye and cut off his hand. And they're brutal enemies. I love Kaz. I've used Kaz in so many games. So many games, but more about that later. It means you can link things to the game. You can play a wizard who is descended from Vecna when he was alive. And the family lives in shame. And so you want to make good on that. But that same ambition that burned in Vecna to make them a lich burns in you. It lets you link the character to the campaign. It's people who play games with me are just nodding their heads like, yeah, Judd, this is obvious. But I used to do it. Here's what I used to do. And I'll tell you how I learned to stop doing it. I used to run a Deadlands game where the players were in a traveling show. And so they would travel from town to town and put on a show. And I did not structure it right. You know, I was a journeyman GM. I had not yet earned the stripes on my belt yet. And it just wasn't very good. And so I'd spend two or three games hiding all of the wonderful mystery and arcane, terrible, fell horror that was hidden in the town. So the players would be looking around, and I would hide it from them. And then finally they'd uncover it. And then there would be, you know, a blowout. But it would take like four sessions. It would take a month. It was so tedious. So tedious. And that's not the way to do it. What changed it for me was the out-of-print game Dogs in the Vineyard, in which what's interesting is what the, you know, you want to unveil what's going on so the players can get involved in the conflict and make a judgment. And so I would just drop it on the players right away. They would walk into town and a kid would walk up to them and be like, are you watchdogs? Are you here to kill the drunk steward? Are you going to shoot him? And they're like, well, let's go talk to the steward. He's clearly a drunk. I mean, this kid knows it. Everyone must know it. Kids are a great way to just get that stuff out. I love using kids. We've talked about that before on this show. And it got to it. It allowed us to get to the the stuff, right? And there are games where I've hidden stuff, right? I ran crime cases in Blades in the Dark, straight up crime cases where there's a murder and they had to figure out what to do. And there was hidden stuff. And there is a real skill to figuring out how do you unveil this stuff. And I didn't pace anything, right? When the players looked in the right place and the dice were good to them and they got to what they needed. And you know what? If they looked in the right place, then we don't need to roll dice. But when they got to the right place, they did looked at the right stuff, and they made some smart moves. They found stuff, and they uncovered things. And I didn't actively try to stop them, right? There might be a villain who is acting out against them, but the thing is, when villains act out against the players learn things about what the villain really wants and what's important to them. So in a way, the villains trying to hide things unveils things. Right? So even when I'm trying to hide things as the GM, I'm still unveiling. I'm still showing intent. So what I'm saying is, with pacing, don't pace it based on player frustration. It means that there's frustration. You know, don't hide the things, unveil, you know, empower the players to unveil the things. And the cool thing I find is that when you hide things a little bit, the players will find avenues to uncover it that you had never considered. And for me, in a game with a mystery, that is the white space on the map. Is the players being like, okay, well, I'm going to go talk to, you know, the clerk at the train. And you're like, oh man, I never even thought about the train clerk. Of course that person saw stuff. Are they already dead? Would the villain have thought of that? Maybe the villain missed it too. Maybe the train clerk is on the run. So suddenly you've got something. You know, oh, that train clerk didn't show up to work today. It's weird that they're like clockwork. It's weird that they didn't get here. Huh, I hope they're all right. And then the players can, you know, well, what's their address? Well, let me get it for you, Inspector. And you're off to the races. Off to the races. And sometimes cases go cold and things don't go right, and then you just move on to the next. And that's it. Mayor of Easttown is a crime drama on HBO. And it is about a police detective played by Kate Winslet, who is kind of a middle-aged grandmother dealing with some missing persons cases in, I don't know if I'd call it small town Pennsylvania. I might call it small city Pennsylvania, right? It's kind of urban. It's kind of rural. It's that in-between state, you know? I get a city of 50 to 60, 75,000 people. I'm getting that kind of vibe. And everything is connected. The person she's chasing who has a drug problem is her old high school basketball buddy's brother, right? So it's all very personal. She has to do some investigating into a priest at the church. Her cousin is the main priest at the church, and so the investigation is one of her cousin's colleagues. Again, it's all very, when you get small town stuff, it's all very personal. And it reminds me of a couple of things. And then another conversation came up in the midst of me talking and watching Mayor of Easttown that got me thinking about small town games with a setting in a small town, and why I've always kind of been drawn towards games, fantasy games, set in a hobbit-like setting. Right, I have a couple of friends. We've always talked about how much we love all Hobbit games, and it's not because we want to hearken back to Tolkien, and honor where we came from necessarily. It is more that I always loved city games. I always loved urban games, even before I had spent a lot of time in cities. But it allowed me to create factions and create an ecosystem in a situation that I understood better. I was more comfortable making a fantasy city than I was making a fantasy dungeon when I was younger. Maybe I still am. I don't know. I can see. I think I get it more now. But back when I was first starting, I couldn't figure out why I loved running city games and I hated running dungeon games when I was 13. No idea. Could not figure it out. And why was I drawn towards this kind of small town Hobbiton vibe? What was there for me? Why was I drawn towards Hobbiton? Because I think it takes the city and condenses it. It makes it even more personal. Suddenly, secrets are kind of known secrets, right? I'm reminded of a friend of mine who grew up in rural Scotland, and he talked about how there was a murder case that could never be solved, and everyone knew that the husband did it. And the husband ran the mechanic shop where everyone got their car fixed. And people would just say, you're bringing your car over to the murderer's place? It was just a known secret. They couldn't find the murder weapon, so he never got charged. And that's the kind of surreal, horrific, terrible things that I think can happen in a rural setting that drew me to it fictionally, right? That's a horrific real life example. So forgive me for that. But fictionally, it works for me, right? Because what we just talked about, unveiling things in the table techniques. And I think the small town vibe allows you to do that. I'll post a link to a Twitter conversation with Sean Drake, who is part of the team that is creating Court of Blades, which is a Forge in the Dark medieval political game. So I'll have a link to the tweet that I'm about to discuss and a link to the Kickstarter. And Sean talks about running a game set in a hobbit-like world as a one-shot, where the hobbits go out into the world like a rumspringer, right? Like they on a walkabout. Like, hey, you all need to go out into the world, see what it's about, and decide if you want to come back. And when you do come back, you'll appreciate what you have, right? You need to see how rough it is out there so that when you come back to the hometown and take them on the mantle of adulthood, you'll appreciate it. You'll appreciate what we have. And that got me thinking about things too. It reminded me, it just brought it all, it bubbled it all up again. What I love about the Hobbiton as like a small town construct, right? In a fantasy way, kind of fake, kind of real, just like a dungeon, right? Hobbiton is kind of a small town dungeon. It doesn't necessarily make sense. It doesn't necessarily, but it does make sense in the greater ecology of things. And that's a weird thing, right? It makes sense, but it doesn't make sense. That needs to be unpacked a little bit. I need to think about that. Okay, it is a fantastic construct that will make sense in the context of other fantastical constructs, but it isn't necessarily realistic. If we dig into it too deep, it might not parse out, and that's okay. We're not going to dig into it too deep, just like we're not going to dig into the elves too deep. We're gonna let our disbelief muscles do some work, and that's cool. And why does that work? I think it works because we all have nosy neighbors. We've all had overbearing aunties. We've all had obnoxious uncles. We all have cousins like Merry and Pippin who get us into trouble, but are there for us at the end. We don't all have gardeners like Samwise, and the world is poorer for it, but we recognize it. We recognize that kind of nobility when we see it. And, you know, we understand. I think we all get Frodo, right? Someone who wants to leave home so bad and then comes home and doesn't ever quite feel right. Doesn't ever quite feel like he fits in. It's just a beautiful metaphor for a lot of things. Whether it's a metaphor for, you know, the war veterans that Tolkien saw, including himself, who came home and never quite felt that kind of coziness again, or whatever it is that you go out into the world, see, and then come back. And it just fits. It works. And I think that's what I took away. That's one of the things I took away. One of the major things I took away from Mare of Easttown is that small town adventure vibe where everything you do is made personal because everywhere you go, there are links to your life. And there are reminders of things that have happened to you. And things and relationships you have. You know, and it's not all, I feel like when I say everything is linked and there are relationships everywhere, I think of times in indie RPGs where we overdid it a little bit. You know, it doesn't have to make every conflict dire. But it does make a lot of conflicts more personal. And it gives those conflicts a face and a context and makes them feel more real. There's another aspect of Mare of Easttown that I'm going to just touch on here because I might come back to it later, where I've been playing Sorcerer lately and I feel, and so I've been rereading those books and rereading things that Ron has written about fiction, and there's something of Sorcerer in this game too, in this piece of fiction. I haven't finished it yet. I don't know how it plays out. You know, I'm hoping we'll get a couple different seasons of it, so we'll get to see how things evolve over the next years, right? But there is something Sorcerer-ish about it in a very similar way that True Detective feels like a Sorcerer game. Right? And a True Detective, for me, the sorcerer is Rust Cole, right? The sorcerer is definitely McConaughey's character, and his demon, to me, is the book, is the notebook he keeps the case information in. And that's in the past. And then when we flash forward, we see that the demon has grown into his, like, storage shed. He no longer carries a book. He's no longer really a detective. But the demon has grown and just consumed his life. And now it's a whole storage facility, right? It's a whole storage pot. With weird words scrawn on the walls. Like, it's really creepy. His storage shed that he keeps the case info in is super creepy looking, and it's straight up a demon. And Mare of Easttown doesn't have the supernatural elements like True Detective does, and it's handling its noir crime issues in a totally different way. So I don't want to compare them too much, but what I am going to compare them is that there's subtle demon stuff here. And I don't know. We're not complete with Mayor of Easttown's, you know, arc yet. I haven't watched the whole first season. It's because it's not out. It's coming on every Sunday. But at first glance, I think her demon is her nicotine inhaler. And I don't know why. It just seems to be there at key moments. And I don't know. I'll get back to you on that. So this is a totally unformed thought. I wasted almost 3 minutes on it. You know, noir fiction as sorcerer fiction and inanimate objects as subtle demons. There's something there. So put a pin in that for me. Thank you. Back to small town vibes. That's what I'm taking away from Mayor of Easttown, is this small town setting with a lot of big city problems, not necessarily the resources to deal with them, and those problems all take on a very human face. And yeah, that's where I'm at. And I feel like Blades in the Dark has some of this too, because the city is so packed, right? Like, part of the vibe of Duskfall and the setting of Blades in the Dark is that there's nowhere to expand to. The lightning fence keeps the ghosts out, but it keeps everyone in. And in our game with Lauren and Strash, we kept referring to Duskfall as a barrel with rats in it. It just is a metaphor that kept coming up over and over and over. And I loved it because it fits. It's a, you know, you put a bunch of rats in a barrel and don't give them any food, and what happens? They start eating each other. And that's what you literally have to do in that game when you're playing Criminal Cruise. You've got to take turf, and that turf belongs to someone else, so you're getting someone else angry. And there you go. And so when you're crammed in like that, again, the urban problems become personal because you know the faces of the people who you're dealing with. I think it's something that I try to do in my Duskfall games is make that real, right? Not every member of a crew is a hard-bitten scoundrel. You know, some of them are students at Charter Hall who have drug problems they need to support, and so they do scoundrel work on the side. Some of them are kids who grew up here and, you know, got out of a bad living situation and found family in the crew, right? Making it all real and personal and true by putting a face on it. And so that is what I would say is my takeaway for Mayor of Easttown, is put a human face on things when you can, even when they're inhuman, you know, even when they're inhuman. Think about how to connect it and make it, you know, who is this? Who are their families? Who is affected by this? Even when there's an inhuman problem going on, right? You know, there's a demon cult. Great. Who's in this cult? Who's the families? Who is there a kid who got away? Who just grew up and married into another family and lives in the next village? Will they talk about their demonic cult, you know, family that they ran away from into this marriage? Was the marriage a good thing? You know, very few people run into it from a bad situation to a perfect situation. They run into the situation, they run where they have to run to survive. I'm just saying, put a human face on things. I think that is That's my takeaway right now from Maravi's town. And I think we'll come back to it maybe when it's complete, and we'll talk about Mare as a sorcerer and detectives as sorcerers and cases as demons, maybe cases as demons, but we'll think about what kind of demons they have and how the case plays into that. That might be a future topic. Detectives as demons and the difference between mysteries and crime, and why that's interesting to me. But for now, Maravi's Town, what I'm digging is the setting as a character and how we can do that. And if I had an eighth day of the week, I would be running an all Hobbit game of D&D like right this second. I am so primed to do that. Like I can't even. So yeah, good stuff. Very good stuff. And that's Maravi's Town. Good one, Inspiration Goat. If you're not watching it, please do. I think it's good. I think it manages to show police work without making it, what are they calling it now, copaganda. I think it skirts that. It's not perfect. Nothing is, but it's not lionizing the whole thing either. And it's good. I think it's fun, and if that's your cup of tea, if a little bit of Pennsylvania small-town crime is your vibe, check it out. I'd love to hear what you think. Thank you for listening to Daydreaming About Dragons. There are a number of ways to support the show. You can leave a review. That's a big way. You can contact me, judd.karlman@gmail.com, and let me know what's going on at your table, if anything that I said resonated or did not make sense, let me know. If you'd like me to dig into something a little more, let me know. You can email me. You can leave me an MP3. You can email me an MP3. You can tweet at me at Inspiration Goat. So, and there should be a link to that in the show notes. If you would like to support the show in other ways, in monetary ways, there are real basic ways to give money every month. I appreciate the folks who do that. And it's lovely. You can buy things from my Threadless shop, which all the proceeds go to cool charities. So I love when my nerdery goes out to make the world a better place. You can purchase a book that I've published. You can purchase one of the PDFs that I've published on DM's Guild. Again, all the links for that will be in the show notes. Thank you so much. I appreciate you. I just got fully vaccinated. My vaccine has hit full power, and I'm excited to hug some friends who are open to hugging. And I hope you're well. I hope you've made it through this safely. And I'll talk to you soon. All right.